This is the third session in a series of conversations in which we're exploring the way in which Jews and Christians can come to know one another better. We don't have any Jews here present, so really the task is for us Christians. You are Jewish.
Yes.
Wonderful. I'm glad to know that, because as we get to the part of our conversation where we have the Jewish interpretations, I would love you to inform us, correct us, and the like. So I assumed that wrongly that most of us here, or at least, well, that's probably correct, that most of us are Christians, but it's also well that we know that we have Jews present too. In this series, I've tried to put together some comments on biblical materials that I take it are familiar to Christians, and to explore the way that their interpretation and use among Christians has in fact led to hatred towards Jews. And of course, as I mentioned in the first two sessions both times, the purpose of our exploring these texts is to confront that fact of the longest hatred, the hatred of Christians towards Jews, in order to come out of Holden restored, and with the theme of this summer, of a whole new world, that part of our wholeness will be a better sense of appreciation and respect for Jews. In any event, today, well, I should just do a brief capsule of where we were yesterday. Yesterday, we looked at the Exodus narrative and suggested that this central theme of the liberation of the children of Israel in the situation of slavery in Egypt, it turns out to be a story that is told and retold and reflected on and reshaped as the tradition corresponds to different points in the life of the history of Israel. The first original moment of the situation of the captives, or the peasants, let's call them the Habiru, we called them yesterday, or the Hebrews in Egypt, and they had this leader, a Levite by the name of Moses, that we saw was terribly important to the story, and that then through a series of centuries of reflection on this, the story got reshaped in a condition, in a time when 12 different groups, 12 different clans or tribes were struggling to do their overthrow of a situation of oppression in the land of Canaan, and that the Moses group became, and their story became part of the story of these peasants uprising in Canaan, and then that story in turn got retold as they had a monarch and had to confront the reality that maybe there could be oppression within their own experience. And that led to a split of the kingdoms, and that at each stage of the retelling of the story, there was an imaginative and creative way of making the story fit the present moment, the here, the now. That when you hear these pronouns in Deuteronomy above all, we or you, it is literally we, the hearers of the passage in 1992, but for those to whom the author of that text was writing, it is those people then, at that moment, at each single moment, this text is meant to be speaking across time and across place to the present situation and condition of the people to whom the texts are addressed. And we're going to see the same thing today, not simply with respect to the story of the liberation of Israel, but also to the story of law. And we're going to see that one of the tensions that that Lutherans especially have been familiar with in our Christian upbringing is a tension between law and gospel. And as I've suggested each time, I'm going to begin with a quotation from one of the great leaders of the Christian Church. Again, I'm going to quote from Martin Luther. This is from his commentary on the Epistle of Paul to the Romans. The law shows nothing but our sin. It makes us guilty and thus produces an anguished conscience. But the gospel supplies a longed-for remedy to people in anguish of this kind. The law is evil and the gospel good. The law announces wrath, but the gospel peace. The law oppresses the conscience with sins, but the gospel frees the conscience and brings peace through faith in Christ. Only after a cumulative hearing of many such passages like this are we as Christians, I think, going to be liberated to the point where we don't have to make such stark, brutal contrasts between our faith convictions about the goodness of the good news that we hear proclaimed through the first century rabbi Jesus, and our full, complete convictions about who he is, that they don't have to be made in a way that is kind of juxtaposed with a kind of animosity in a dualistic way of us against them. Rather, we're going to see, I hope, that in fact we can make our faith stance, our convictions about who Jesus is, with greater knowledge about his Jewishness, and in that way begin to put to one side the kinds of contrasts that have been made in the past between ourselves and Jews. Today's texts, or today's materials, I should say, have to do with the development of law in both in ancient Israel and in the Christian community, and how we see these things as related to one another. As with yesterday, I'd like to first of all suggest that there's a kind of a way in which you can't freeze the making of law at any one given moment. We can say, for example, that our Constitution in the United States was written in 1787 and sent out to the states to be ratified, but even that generated a dramatic process of change that resulted in the first Congress taking on the task of modifying the power of the federal government in the first 10 amendments that were put on there, known as the Bill of Rights, and then in a series of amendments that are all called for in the original document. In Article 5, it tells us how the states can call for a constitutional convention to change the whole thing. It was that kind of radical change that our original Constitution represented anyhow. Because before that, from 1776 up to 1787, we were governed much more loosely by the kind of thing that I suggested yesterday we could better call a confederacy than a federal relationship, namely a loose kind of bonding that was set forth in the Articles of Confederation. Anybody here want to tell me who the first president of the United States was? Just to test your historical skills. Sorry? That's correct. Anybody not know that before you came to Holden? See, there are always reasons for coming to Holden.
Was he Swedish?
Was he Swedish? That we don't know. Here's the story. We're used to thinking of George Washington as the first president because we're used to thinking of the Constitution as when, you know, American law really gets going, when we, the people, or at least those few representatives in Philadelphia that purported to represent, they, as we pointed out yesterday, didn't include women, didn't include slaves, and so forth. But we think of that period as the formative period. And in fact, in the Articles of Confederation, the president was a kind of a flunky. He was the person who was a secretary for the Congress, which didn't meet very often. So it wasn't a very important job, so that's maybe why Al had to tell us the name of the guy. We wouldn't have thought of him spontaneously, and we don't have any national holiday to celebrate. Well, when we begin to take a look at Exodus chapter 19, once again we get one of these chronological time marks right in the book that it is part of the concern of the community in the Second Temple period, when it's really concerned about calendar and, you know, getting to Bible study on time and when do you ring the bell and on what day do you do this, that, and the other thing. All these chronological indicators are part of, I won't say the nervousness of the priestly writers, the people who are governing the community at the time of the return from the exile. But they're sort of what goes into law in their head. Is they're always concerned about, you know, getting to the church on time, as the song goes in My Fair Lady. Well, so also here, we start off right off the bat with a notation that tells us, this idea of Sinai may not be just one frozen frame, one moment in time, in, let's say, the year, to give the Sinai event back here a date, sometime in, let's say, the 13th down to the 12th century. We don't have a precise date to tell exactly when the newly emancipated slaves found themselves in the Sinai wilderness under their leader Moses, but the point is, that is not how law develops, either in an American experience or in ancient Israel. It's a very fluid, continually developing sort of thing. And what we note about this original setting, what I want to just say about the word Kenites, is that we don't know an awful lot about that community either, but there's a tradition at least that is associated with this part of the Sinai Peninsula near this mountain, in which the people are thought to be descendants of Cain, and they're thought indeed to have the mark of Cain that we hear about in Genesis 4. Does anybody remember who Cain was? We all undoubtedly have heard the story about Adam and Eve having trouble raising Cain, right? What did Cain do to his brother Abel?
Killed him.
So he was a murderer. And yet, not a murderer that was beyond the protection of God. Not a murderer who is beyond the reach and strength of God. And so this sanctuary in the wilderness was established as a kind of a haven, safe place, a protection place for runaway slaves, for social outcasts, indeed for escaped criminals. In a world where death penalty was the typical sentence for even relatively trivial offenses, to get away, you had to get away good. And here in the desert was some place, according to these traditions, that are identified with Cain, and they call Kenites. And another thing that's going to come into the story is the symbol of fire. And as it turns out, these people were also very much associated with fire. They were smithies, so that's how one way you might translate the word. They made implements of iron and brass in the late Bronze Age. Now, to forge instruments of that sort, you need lots of intense heat that comes from big burning fire. We're going to see that too surrounds part of the background of this event. We don't have anything like, you know, certain knowledge about these people, but it's a way of situating the Sinai narrative there in that particular place in a way that's different to a typical naturalistic approach that says, well, the God of Israel is as a God who blows a stack, a God of volcanoes, a God. But that's what Sinai is. That Sinai is a big whoosh, rush of flames and thunderous noise into the sky as Mount St. Helens blows its stack, sort of thing. One of the problems with that alternative view of what Sinai was all about is that there's just no evidence of volcanic rock in that area. But again, it's not that we want to bring the tools of archaeology to bear as though they're the only things that can tell us anything about these narratives. In any event, what we do have among the ancients generally is a conception of fire representing divine power, both to purify and to consume, just as we saw yesterday. Water was life-giving and death-dealing, both. It's one of those ambivalent symbols that go either way. Well, so also with fire, one of the central symbols of Exodus chapter 19. Indeed, the profession of these Kenites, their smithies, or, you know, people who create instruments in metal, is connected with their religion, and they think of God as associated with fire. Now, how does that play into the Exodus narrative? Assuming, first of all, you remember the story of Moses taking it out on the brutal Egyptian character who was, forcing the Hapiru slaves to work too hard, and he bashes someone and he dies. Then where does it go? Do you remember from yesterday's story, anybody? He goes out to the...
To the
wilderness, and in fact it's Midian, not Moab, but that's the region where these people lived. And there he has this strange encounter with not only a bush that talks, but a bush that burns and doesn't go out. Right, a burning bush, and hence this bush on fire that is the place where God reveals either some name that's got significance or refuses to give a name. There are many ways of interpreting that particular passage. I am who I am may mean, and it's possible, you don't get a name, buddy, at least in the sense that you don't get to manipulate me in the way that magicians in the ancient world, once they got the name of the deity, could then invoke the deity, say, come down and do this magic trick for me. That's not the kind of God that the God of Israel is. It's not within subject to the beck and call of magical incantations. It may mean I am there for you, as we say in contemporary parlance. I won't give up on you. I'll be around. It could have a future sense. It may even mean I will bring into being. It could have some kind of causative notion. I will cause what I will cause, or maybe it just means. My name is mysterious, and you don't get it all now. You have to hang around for the last act in the play, because there's more in store to be revealed. So it has all of those possibilities, but in any event, it's linked again with fire. And we know that the stories place Moses there with the Kenites as the son-in-law of their priest. He intermarries with them. We saw yesterday that the concept of God that he brings to bear to these slaves could very well be influenced by the fact that he is drawn from the water, that he is Moshe, he is taken out of the water and saved and rescued, and by whom, do you remember? Does that happen? By Pharaoh's daughter. So he grows up in court, he grows up as an Egyptian little boy. And at the time when there's a great religious movement going on to purify the pantheon of the Egyptian deities, many, many, God for this, that, and the other thing. I'm sure you've seen the symbols of them, the hieroglyphs. If not, I want to call to your attention that we have in the library a couple of books, a five-volume dictionary of the Bible that has lots of wonderful illustrations in there, and you can find lovely pictures of the ancient world. All you have to do is thumb through it and stop anywhere. I'm going to recommend two pieces in here today, in particularly the article on covenant, but we'll get to that in a minute. But in any event, if you want to see pictures of hieroglyphs and what that's all about, and you can just literally thumb through there in a couple of minutes and get an idea of what these pictures were like. And the one picture that comes out of Aton religion, A-T-O-N, was the idea that there was just one God, not a whole bunch of gods, which of course is right at the heart of Mosaic faith, and which distinguishes Israel from the religions of the ancient world quite dramatically. So a child reared in the court of Pharaoh at the time when this religious movement was going on could have been influenced by that. He could have been influenced by these Kenites and so forth. But in any event, we have another story in the wilderness stories dealing with how they are led out into the wilderness. Daytime, what guides them is... Anybody recall that part of the Exodus narratives?
The cloud.
A pillar of cloud. And then by night, it's a little bit clearer. What is it?
Fire.
It's fire. So whether these are smoke signals, as the Native Americans would do by day, and brilliant bonfire by night, again, fire turns out to be a central part of the story. So it should come to us as no surprise that fire is a remarkably important symbol here in Exodus 19 itself. Actually, we should read 19 and 24 together as telling us something about the bonding of these people, and I'm going to use that word bonding differently to the way the kind of covenant we saw in the Abraham stories on Monday, where in Genesis 15 and in 17, the idea was that if this animal is cut in half and people walk through the middle of it, it's a way of pledging to one another that they will never go back on their word to one another. Whereas here, it's a more complex set of political relationships that are described in the article that I will commend to you, especially in the supplementary volume. It's a little bit easier to get, and it'll take you maybe 10, 15 minutes to read that article. It's just called Covenant, Mosaic. There's also one on Abraham and there was one on David. But the one on Moses is the one that is most helpful for understanding these chapters here. About, maybe 40 years ago, was it, Fred, that Kerosek wrote his things on the Hittite treaties, thereabouts. And then maybe 30 years ago, there was a scholar in, I believe, in Pennsylvania, in Pittsburgh. Anyhow, his name was George Mendenhall. And he was very much struck by a pattern that seemed to be recurring in a lot of the political treaties or documents that describe the relationship between the head of a city-state and a little tiny suburb, a vassal state or tiny little city that would bind those two together. A little bit different from the image of the animal that's cut in half and I'll never go back on my word to you, or if I do, then I'm going to be cut in half too. Here, there's a kind of a recurrent pattern, said this scholar by the name of Kerosek, and he studied documents that came out of what we now call Turkey, but was then called the Hittite Empire, roughly from the 14th down to the 12th century. So because that is roughly the time of Exodus, and we saw yesterday, we don't have a precise date for when these slaves got out of Egypt, there was a thought that, well, we ought to explore this. Maybe there's some connection between the covenant idea that's in Exodus and the covenant idea that was floating around the ancient world as a political way of describing relationships and the bonds that come. First of all, it isn't just like a me and you kind of covenant, which that animal cut in half could be a kind of a parody, two people agreeing that they will never break partnership with one another. Instead, it's a much more complicated political arrangement in which one person is clearly on top. And that's the person who starts the talking in the preamble. I, Supilu Lemus, that's, believe it or not, the same one of these guys, but say, I, Richard J. Daley, the mayor of Chicago, do this. And that's about the extent of an empire in those days. It was something about the city of Chicago. At least in terms of population. It had greater geographical extent, but probably not much more authority than a mayor. But nonetheless, a lot of clout in those days. I, Richard J. Daley. And then I'm going to tell you all the things that I've done for you. What's good for the south side of Chicago? I should probably pick images that are a little bit more familiar, but I don't know Billings, Montana very well, or even how to pronounce Helena. So there I am, stuck with these crude analogies to the ancient world. In the first part, you would just, the name of the person comes out and you know this person is in charge of this covenant. It's not an even Stephen 50-50 deal. And in the historical prologue, usually lots of military adventures are recounted and you get the picture of dependency, of need, that this person is. You better not forget the day that I had to send my team down there and rescue you guys from a pretty horrible situation. Now, let's get things straight. Remember what I've done for you, and now let's be clear about what you must do to to maintain covenant with me. And these are called the stipulations, legal formulae of one sort or another. This shows up in some of the treaties, but not all, and that's why I recommend the supplementary volume article, because it's a little bit clearer on these matters. And it says, but the point of it is this document, known as a covenant, was to be put in a sanctuary and read out on an annual basis. Generally, people started to speculate, well, that was probably an annual covenant renewal ceremony at the beginning of the year, sort of New Year's Day resolutions that we go through, but probably not broken on January the 2nd with as much rapidity. Why? Because, watch it, the strong arm of the emperor is going to come down on you if you don't. Also, there's a whole list of deities that come in here. Divine witnesses are invoked, and may the God of the sun, and the God of the moon, and the God of the stars, and the God of this, and the God of that, well, all sort of called in on the deal to make sure that this covenant is thought of as a very important, serious matter. And then finally, the stuff from the ancient world that is most familiar to an Irishman like myself, the blessings and the curses. Indeed, in Ireland, the difference between a blessing and a curse is often a very blurry line. And it's not just after several pints of Guinness that occurs. In fact, we have an ambiguity of loyalty and friendship that at least goes this way: I'll bless you or I'll curse you, whichever you wish. And some of the blessings are of doubtful good, like may you die in Ireland, or land without rent to you. That's a blessing. Everybody can figure that out. Child every year to you. I don't know. It's getting a little bit maybe over the ambiguous part, but may you die in Ireland, and those are three blessings that go right after another. Well, if I should have brought along a copy of some of these curses. They are rich, and may you turn into a shriveled little serpent in the desert, and may your entrails come out, and it gets really the sort of stuff that you don't even want to even talk about except at it before a solidarity meal, because it would really spoil anybody's sense of the meal that would come after this if I read out some of these curses. And they're really horrific, horrible stuff. Well, there was a lot of enthusiasm once this chart was put on the board, so to speak, by Mendenhall, that, well, that's what the Mosaic Covenant is. Look, right there in Exodus chapter 20, you get let's just read through some of these provisions now. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 20. And who wants to read verse 1? Go ahead.
And God spoke all these words.
Okay, so now let's just stop right there. Then who spoke all these words? Then God spoke all these words. So that's what they would say is the kind of a preamble. Not much of a preamble, and in fact, not much of a historical prologue, but which would be the next verse. Go ahead.
I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. You shall have no other gods before me.
Okay, so we get monotheism now linked with the story of the rescue, of the emancipation of these slaves in Egypt. And then what about the stipulations? What are God's stipulations? We don't have to read this list out, although the Supreme Court of the United States has said it's unconstitutional to post them in a public school, we pretty well know them in one form or another, and we'll see that in a moment that there is more than one form. The Ten Words, the Ten Commandments. And let's just focus for a moment on that first one. What's the first commandment? Have no other gods before me. And then kind of a repeat performance. Don't make any images of me. Don't make any mirror images or any idols, any graven images that has led, for example, the Jehovah's Witnesses to think of a duty to resist the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, because they think of the flag as a graven image, and that for them falls under this prohibition. They can't stand up and do that. to them that comes too close to violating the second commandment. But for Jews of all times, and remember we're technically using the term Jews to refer to the people after the exile in the southern kingdom, at least the Judahites are the people from whom we derive the term the Jew. In any event, for them, this is so central. This first commandment is just right at the heart of their religious commitment. That when we saw that Christians began to require them to modify their convictions about this matter, that tempted some of the rabbis to go back to reinterpret the Binding of Isaac story in such a way as re-emphasizing this first commandment. It's much better to stay faithful to the holy name of God and to the oneness of his being than to compromise your faith as a Jew by becoming a Christian. And better to die a martyr to that holy name than to give up on the first commandment. It's one of the most basic central conflicts between Jews and Christians as to how to understand the identity of Jesus in a way that does not conflict with this commandment. And for Jews, it is simply not possible to do that without violating the first commandment. For them, they see God is only one. God can't be completely present in a human being. And then, you know, some Christians took the easy way out by saying, well, this wasn't really a human being. Jesus was only play acting. It was only a form of a human being. But that gets defined as a mistake, as a heresy, as we say in Greek, as a non-orthodox, as a non-correct statement of Christian faith. And we can't expect, again, all the subtle sophistication of theological reasoning to bear in at a person who is being forced to choose between a formula that, you know, comes out of Hellenistic or Greek philosophical speculation about how to understand who Jesus is, with this one basic notion that goes right to the heart of the Sinai Covenant, namely, no other gods before me. It's basic to the Aton worship that arose and then was put down with great severity in Egypt, but that could have influenced Moses, and it also turns out to be part of the experience of these strange and mysterious Kenites. In any event, that accounts for the stipulation. Now, what about the deposit of a covenant and its annual reading? Do we have any memories in the Hebrew Bible about the covenant being deposited somewhere? And do we have any evidence of an annual ceremony of covenant renewal?
The ark,
not Noah's. But the ark that turns out to be in the temple period, in the temple of Solomon, and then at the time of the exile in the second temple, it mysteriously disappears, and we don't know where it's gone. It's one of those puzzles of history that it's simply there. But the idea is some sacred sanctuary, and it may be before the Jerusalem monarchy with David and Solomon and so on, that in this period it could have been any number of the shrines, these holy places, where such a sacred document could be deposited. But in these stories, it's always in this sacred box. It's got very precise definition and so on like that. It may be influenced very much by these priests who are wanting those kinds of particular details about temple worship to be part of the story, and they read it back in, they certainly read it back into the Exodus 19 story. We heard that we get a precise date, just as all of us, even if we couldn't tell you who the first president is, all of us could tell you the date of the Declaration of Independence. We'd all say July the 2nd. Gotcha. But yeah, we celebrate on the 4th. But no one would fool around with July the 4th. We'd know that one. Well, similarly here. So again, remember that this is always in a state of flux and fluidity until we finally get the final shape of the Torah, the Bible, much later. In any event, we have in Joshua 24 a very important account of a covenant renewal ceremony. that it's not enough, just as we saw yesterday, that it's not enough for the Passover story to be retold about some past generation in the 13th century, but that each Jew, each Israelite who is celebrating Seder knows that this present moment is the moment of freedom, is the moment of liberation, is the moment of becoming God's people. So also with the legal development. It's at the time that that text is being read out that the covenant is being made anew. And perhaps you may recall the story that is in conflict with Mosaic leadership, the forming of the covenant in Sinai, and so on like that. When Moses comes down from Sinai, what does he encounter with the people in the wilderness area who haven't gone up there? What's this?
They're having a bad time or a good time.
They're having a bad time or a good time. That's well stated in Jewish theology. You know? So I was checking on him. What does that mean? What's the good time part? What are they doing?
I don't want to speak in
front of them. Oh, no, go ahead. It's all right. You're my friend.
A lot of fornication, a lot of idols being
born. Idols! Now, again, archaeologically, I mean, from the point of view of what the historians have dug up, maybe this golden calf idea isn't quite as horrendous as it may seem at first glance. Could be just the supporting place where, you know, the mysterious presence of the one God is to be found. But even that, it's already approaching too much. The idea of what the first commandment prohibits. And it's certainly interpreted that way in Exodus 34 as a violation of the first commandment. And we know from the other commandments that there's some problem with the other stuff that what's going on too. But the big thing that gets Moses really angry is the golden calf story. And what does he do to the covenant document? Smashes it. What's the significance, do you think, of that?
I guess he lost faith in his people.
He did.
And said they didn't deserve to have...
They don't deserve to be the covenant people anymore.
Exactly.
So if you haven't got a covenant to deposit, or to read out, it means the covenant's over. It's finished.
Yeah, Charlton Heston did a good job.
Bingo, it's gone. Hence, you need a new covenant, right? You're going to keep it going, you got to get a new one. And indeed, upon the death of any monarch in the ancient world, one of the first things that you had to do was to get a new covenant going. You had to get a new one of these legal treaties, setting out all the relationships and making clear who's on first and what's on second and who is he and he is who. That's a Hebrew pun on the Abbot Costello joke. For those who don't know Hebrew in the audience, who is he in Hebrew and he is who. But anyhow, it takes us too far from Abbot Costello. But the who's on first story is all about making clear who's in charge here. And upon the death of Mark, or in this case, where Moses is just so mad that he breaks the tablets, then you haven't got a covenant, and you have to get it going. Hence, Exodus also includes a covenant renewal story, as does Joshua 24. Now, this list of divine witnesses, we can't find that in Exodus, can we? It's an easy one, folks. I just said the first commandment. Read the first commandment again, and then?
One God.
One God. One God. Hence, we're not going to find this long list of divine witnesses, but there's a strange echo of that that we omitted last Monday when we were celebrating Rock Day, and that is that the stones in the deserts will be witnesses to the place where this covenant ceremony has occurred. It may be, as I say, one of the gathering shrines of the tribes that this thing is really reflecting, but we have this sort of strange echo that even there's got to be this witness, and it turns out to be the rocks will be the witnesses to the fact that the covenant has occurred. But no long list of other deities. Why? Because that's just not what this kind of a covenant is. And then in Deuteronomy chapters 27 and 28, you'll find a long list of blessings and curses that are precisely the tail end, as one scholar in Germany by the name of Gerhard von Rad has shown, the very structure of the Book of Deuteronomy follows that of an ancient covenant and winds up precisely with two chapters of this kind of a thing that we'll reflect. Now, as I say, we know an awful lot more now about this idea of covenant, and even in the last 25 years since Karosik first wrote, he was mainly talking about the documents that were found up in Turkey. And now we know a lot more about the documents that are from the 8th century before the Common Era, this period in here, the period of the monarchy, which is, after all, if we remember from yesterday, if the Bible is developing along and reflecting the various time periods, then maybe these treaties or covenants would be as important, if not more important, than the Hittite documents in casting light on what it is that was meant by a covenant. This was the time, remember, of Isaiah's crisis, Micah, those prophets who were troubled by the Assyrians going to finally destroy Israel, as they did in 722, and failed to destroy Judah, the southern kingdom, but nonetheless at least try to and do a pretty horrific job in Jerusalem, and yet the southern kingdom survives. But now think of the community that is, let me back up one step. That's why I commended this article in the supplementary volume. And it takes you about 10, 15 minutes to read it, and it's pretty straightforward and doesn't have a lot of technical language in it. It's something that you could do while you're here. In the 5th volume of the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, he shows that, well, you don't always have a historical prologue, you don't always have this matter, but there's some things that you just have to have a legitimate treaty document in the ancient world. And that will tell us something about the kind of relationship that God wishes for his people. One that where there are stipulations with clear content and purpose and meaning to it. There's another development just before the Babylonian exile of a prophet by the name of Jeremiah. Again, that's terribly crucial to the formation of the law itself. And does anybody recall what he has to say about covenant? Yeah, he too is concerned about this theme of a new covenant. He's worried that the people have abandoned the heart and soul of the stipulations of the Mosaic covenant, and so he wishes there to be a renewal within the people. He wants them to not be so stony-hearted and to have fleshy hearts, and those of you who know anything about double or triple bypass will know that this muscle is, you do too. Gosh, you know all kinds of things.
Twice.
And here you are to tell us about it. This muscle has got to keep going, keep the lifeblood pumping through the body. Well, so also, the lifeblood of God's presence to his people will be coursing through the whole people if they're in a right relationship with one another. But if they're doing things like lying, cheating, stealing, murdering, easy relationships with their neighbors, with surrounding them that compromise their faith, the very thing that the Binding of Isaac story was attempting to get at, this recurrent temptation within Israel to please the other deities too, and sacrifice the first child, kill the kid, in order to look like a Moabite or an Ammonite, one of these absolutely horrendous abomination practices. Well, it turns out to be, that's not something way back when was settled on Sinai one day. It turns out to be one of those temptations that happened over and over and over and over again. And that the law always needs to renew and purify the experience of Israel to make her God's holy chosen people, the kingdom of priests. Maybe originally that refers only to this Levite tribe that Moses is associated with. Not this other, maybe it didn't mean the entire gang, but a kingdom of priests. priests of Kohanim. So to this day, we have the custom at synagogue of having the Kohens called upon by the rabbi to stand up and lift the Torah scroll and bring it around in a great processional ceremony until it's, you know, kissed and put on the thing with great reverence. Why? Because whenever two or three are gathered to read and study Torah, there the divine presence is to be found. A saying that no doubt is familiar to Christians in a slightly different version, but an ancient Jewish way of respecting God's presence in the law. Rushing ahead to the New Testament period, the passage in the Gospel of Matthew that I want to fix on for a moment and then just say something very briefly about Matthew as the Gospel is the idea that Jesus did not come to get rid of Torah, to abolish the law. Even though you might take that implication from Martin Luther's statement about law gospel, you might get the idea that there's a deep, stark tension between law and gospel. In fact, we find one of the gospels telling us that Jesus does not come to abolish Torah, but rather to renew it, to fulfill it, to bring it to fullness. In the Second Temple period and right down to the time when Jesus is writing, especially into this period after Jesus, the rabbis had enormous authority to interpret the text. Indeed, they then start telling us that in the oral tradition of the law, it was all given by God back in Sinai, way back when. And it just takes them a little while to unfold it. And some of the burdens came to be pretty hard to fulfill. But I want to say a couple of things about these rebels. First of all, they were doing it out of enormous devotion to the law. They did it because they were enthused by the law. And all you have to do to check that out is to read a few verses of Psalm 118. They go on and on about the statutes and the laws of God and do so with you know, in a poetic singing sort of way. And whenever I ask my students in the law school at Valpo if they ever know any songs about the law, they kind of look at me funny. The best response that I've got so far is, "Who shot the sheriff?" We don't get wildly enthusiastic about law. And it's not because we're anarchists, we just kind of take it for granted that there'll be rules in community. I discovered the rules of this community when I started washing dishes the other day. That in order to prevent dysentery, who would want that to break out in camp? That would be a terrible thing. We couldn't even all get down to the boat fast enough. you'd need Noah, build me an ark, whatever. There are all kinds of ritual purification rules that go on in that kitchen. And after it's been washed, then it's disinfected, then it's this, and then it's put through a hobar where the steam is going to take care of and kill any possible germ. And I'm handing one of the pots over there. No, you can't touch that, she said. You're unclean. Unclean. It's the first time I've thought of myself as a leper. You know, and maybe I need to get inside of that mentality before I realize, oh, of course, you do need rules in camp in order to have these other values. You know, you need law. And maybe there's some good news in that. There's something good, some gospel in the law. That's the way we kind of have to deal with one another. Well, in this period of the New Testament and the immediate period after the formation of the New Testament, the rabbis were very, very important in shaping the understanding and interpretation of the law. Let's go back to this passage in Matthew and then say a few things about the whole structure of that gospel, and then I'm going to stop so that we can have some time to talk about law and gospel in your experience. As those of you that went to Bible study the other morning with Fred Niedner will remember, the scholars in the New Testament field have now identified that there are five chunks of materials in that gospel that, you know, first have a couple of chapters of narratives or stories of what happens, and then a long discourse, and then another unit that begins with a couple of chapters of narrative discourse, five times. And then we have this strange phenomenon of the mountain, the Sermon on the Mount, not on the plains, as in Luke. So that they've pretty well got the idea that Matthew is trying to draw a picture of Jesus as though he is the new Moses. And in one of these scenes, it's terribly important that identification is made crystal clear, that he's both law and prophets on a mountain place at the time of the Feast of Booths, or at least surrounded with this sort of idea. How's that story told? Does anybody recall a word that would trigger it for you? Well, let me just say the word transfiguration, and then see if you can't recall who is there on the mountain with Jesus.
And
Moses. Now, in Luke, it's that he's at prayer. He's, you know, having this, what a pious Jew would do. He's reflecting on Torah and on the prophetic tradition, and there's this burning awareness that he must do the will of God for his times and is to be the best possible interpretation of the law, the best possible interpretation of the prophetic tradition to his people at the present moment. There's not some contrast that he's a Christian and he's against Jews. It's rather that he is meant in his own self-understanding to embody the law at its finest, at its best, at its richest, namely at the point where it interacts with the prophetic tradition, that the laws aren't against the prophets and the prophets aren't against the law. Those kinds of dichotomies are now thought to be kind of overdrawn, exaggerated, and frankly incorrect, that those, just as law and prophets influence one another in the shaping of the tradition, so also in the law and the gospel situation, we really find that that there's some good news to be found in the law itself. But in between Jesus, the Moses type, the prophet type, and us, is this debate in the first century, and then it gets worse and worse in the fourth century among Christians, as to who the Jewish Christians were and what their role in the community would be. Did all Christians coming to identify Jesus as the Messiah, as the anointed one, had to be Jewish in the sense of fulfilling all the demands of the law? Remember that the rabbi said that there wasn't going to be any big differentiation. If you had a rule, that's a rule, that's a mitzvah, it's a duty, you have to do it, it's an obligation. And so Jesus, as a rabbi, is kind of protesting about some of the rules. And that's standard fare among rabbis. Rabbis quarrel with one another. They push the dimensions of the law out to really interesting new questions. What's going to go on tonight here at Holden Village is, what about the bioethics and genetic engineering and so on like that? Well, that's not a question as to which the rabbis are silent. But not all rabbis will agree with one another. What about abortion? One of the controversies that deeply divides America. That's not a question about which the rabbis are silent, but it's not an issue as to which all rabbis agree with one another. What about anything else that's happening in the world around them? Ever since Jews found themselves as a minority out of power, they have been reflecting about the laws of the culture that they find themselves in. And they've been doing it in a way that does it in a dialogue with the Mosaic Law, with the covenant, and tries to find something there, even a word will do, something that links up or that triggers their imagination or that goes off in an imaginative, creative way to find a way of making God's covenant with his people real here and real now. That is Jewish legalism at its best, at its finest. And to deprecate the Jewish legal tradition simply because you think that your convictions about Jesus are correct is to make a big mistake as a Christian. You don't have to do that. You don't have to define the gospel of your faith in a way that is contrary to the law. And a thought occurred to me when I was talking with Earl yesterday, that how did Paul, who was himself a rabbi, he calls himself one of the strictest of Jews, a Pharisee of Pharisees, that is, say, right in there with the strictest interpretation of the law. How does he deal with the fact that he wants Christianity to become open to the non-Jews, the Gentiles? He deals with it by taking up a collection among the Gentiles to send money to the poor people in Jerusalem, the Jewish Christians, who are left, you know, in a terrible situation of tension between themselves and the Jews in the temple, and who eventually by the year 80 are cut off from even going to synagogue, can't go to synagogue anymore because there's a part of the prayer saying we don't want people that confess that Jesus is the Messiah coming to synagogue anymore. It's too confusing for Jews to have these Jewish Christians around. So they have to find some other way of worship. And how do they find that? They find that in part with the support of the leader of Gentile Christianity, Paul, who doesn't bash them, who doesn't say, you should have nothing to do with us, we're not going to have anything to do with you. Rather, he finds ways of reaching out and being helpful. Well, I think that model of the collection that's referred to in the second letter of Paul to the Corinthians might give us a way of rethinking what law and gospel could be for our times. But I think the first starting place is for us to realize that there's a lot of good news in the law of ancient Israel that calls for looking after the widows, the orphans, the helpless, the dispossessed, the lowest of the low, exactly the people about whom the Kenites were concerned. The outcasts, the criminals, the folks that in the long run, in Matthew's gospel, turned out to be precisely what God's judgment and God's law is all about. It's identifying with those who are in a situation of human need, thirst, hunger, prison, and the like. That's what, of course, is a big surprise for some folks. They thought it had to do with liturgical formula, like saying, Lord, Lord, this and that. Getting the liturgical prayers down. Instead, it has to do with identifying in the way that mitzvah or obligation in Jewish law requires and binds us to do, is to care about people in a situation of human need. That's where I think our appreciation that there is some really good news in the law might help us overcome this antagonism towards Jews that regrettably has been part of our heritage. That hasn't happened before. I'm afraid we're again pushing the time limits, but if there's some thoughts that come to you, you're more familiar with this law-gospel tension than I am, perhaps some of you might wish to share about that.
Question?
Yeah, please.
Your wonderful description of the law, reference to the kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
The cleanliness, that you're not clean and so forth. Why did the Christians not adopt the kosher laws of the Hebrews?
That goes in part to this conflict that I mentioned about the Apostle Paul. He was himself Jewish, but when he had an intense experience that turned him around, and began to realize that he had a mitzvah or a duty to spread the good news about Jesus to Gentiles. He was one who was prepared to persecute Christians because he thought that was a violation of the first commandment, in effect. He was the strictest of Jews, and he first took that kind of a hardline rabbinic position towards them. Not characteristics, for example, of Rabbi Hillel, who would say, well, rabbis just squabble with one another all the time. Let's find out whether or not this is going to go a certain way. And also Gamaliel represents that kind of an attitude. So basically, Christians don't follow the kosher laws because of Paul's insistence that the Gentile Christians, not the Jewish Christians in the diaspora, are not going to be burdened anymore. And it's found in two documents above all, the letter to the community in Galatia and to the community in Rome. That's where he sets out his clearest teaching. It's where the Reformation took this clear statement about law and gospel being contrasted with one another. So we don't observe the kosher laws in the sense that that observant Jews would, but and many other laws. But that doesn't mean that, that we're entitled to either to depreciate or to be antagonistic toward those who do.